Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Dive into the start of summer at Whole Foods Market. Check out their summer splash event with sales on fresh organic produce, organic strawberries, and a fan favorite sale on Ben & Jerry's and Talenti. Explore deals on grill-friendly meats like organic air-chilled chicken breast, beef and chicken kebabs, all with no antibiotics ever from our meat department. Plus, grab easy sides from prepared foods and cool off with refreshing drinks. Kick off your summer and shop in-store or online at Whole Foods Market today.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This podcast contains graphic descriptions of sensitive subject matter dealing with violence, death, and self-harming behavior. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call 988.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It took all of 20 seconds for Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead to be escorted from the third floor courtroom at the Montgomery County Courthouse to the exit elevator after her guilty verdict was read. 10 months earlier, she'd been charged with first-degree murder for killing her 11-year-old son, Matthew. The cause of death? Strangulation. A brutal way to go that medical examiners estimated took 3 to 5 minutes. Ruth passed reporters on her way out of the courtroom.
Anything further to say, Mrs. Whitehead?
Ruth, any minute.
Yeah, actually, sure. I'm heartbroken. Sure,
I'm heartbroken, she said. After that, Ruth and the two sheriff's deputies flanking her disappeared behind a creaky elevator door. And she was off to state prison, where she'll presumably spend the rest of her life. Moments later, Lauren Marvel and Gwendolyn Call made the same walk. They work in the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office and prosecuted the case. Marvel and Call are also mothers.
This is one of the most horrific cases I think either of us has ever worked on. It's very easy to do a difficult job when you care so deeply about the outcome and about the people involved.
So this case has been touching to us in more ways than just one, and it really truly is an honor to be able to speak for Matthew now that he can no longer speak for himself, and to hold Ruth Whitehead accountable for what she did to tear apart her own family and this community.
Take out a motion, follow the evidence. That's the job of a prosecutor in any case. Follow the evidence wherever it takes you, easy or hard.
The defendant spoke a lot about how apologetic she was today and how much grief she felt today. The words that she spoke in the courtroom don't reflect her behavior.
In part one of this podcast, we heard from the defense and witnesses who testified on Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead's behalf. We revisited what life was like for her before it all went wrong, what Matthew meant to her, how she cared for him, and the forces that could have caused a loving mother to kill. Now, we'll hear from the prosecutors, who painted a far different picture of Ruth than most of her closest family and friends could have ever imagined.
It makes you question, am I incapable of catching this kind of thing? Does that mean I'm less safe than I assume I am?
We'll also learn more about Daniel Whitehead, the man whose world was torn apart when his wife did the unthinkable to their only child, arguably out of resentment and revenge.
When his son was murdered by his wife, it almost destroyed him. Because that was his life. His family, his son and his wife. Now both of them are gone. He is still grieving, and he's still working through the trauma of finding his son deceased in his own bed, knowing that his wife was the one who killed him.
I'm Jim Melworth. From KYW News Radio Original Podcasts, this is Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead. The Mother, the Monster, Part 2. Lauren Marvel has worked in the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office for years.
The day this homicide happened, I was 8 months pregnant, and I remember thinking to myself, well, it's not going to be my case because I'm about to go on maternity leave. And then
we talked about the case about a week or so after it wrapped up.
I was surprised to have it assigned to me because typically when you're getting ready to go out on leave and you know you'll be gone for a while, our homicide cases move pretty quickly through the system. But it was at a time when our office was incredibly busy with homicides in general, and also the experienced people in the office that are ready to try a homicide were pretty tied up.
I was actually at home when I got the email from our first assistant assigning me as co-counsel with Lauren Marvel on this case.
This is Gwendolyn Cole. She and I talked a few days after my interview with Marvel.
It was very early on in the proceeding. I hadn't even seen the complaint yet, but I started seeing the news stories come out, and it was just devastating.
Breaking news on KYW News Radio.
Authorities investigating the death of an 11-year-old boy. Body was found this morning inside a bedroom of his home in Horsham, Montgomery County. Around 7 a.m. when Horsham police arrived, where they found Matthew Whitehead dead in bed in the master bedroom. The boy's father was the one who initially found him and called 911 after he noticed the bedroom door was locked and his wife's black Toyota Highlander was not parked in the garage. According to authorities, Matthew spent the night in the room with his mother, Ruth.
Your first reaction, especially as a mother, is to be confused as to how this could have gotten to murder for a mother. But then quickly thereafter, you start going through the evidence and piecing together what actually happened. And even though for the average person, it's completely unfathomable and irrational, what she did actually made perfect sense.
And made perfect sense. What do you mean by that?
So her actions were actually very logical and thought out and premeditated.
As far as Marvel and Call were concerned, the evidence was clear. Ruth's crime was first-degree murder all the way. In Pennsylvania, only first-degree murder charges come with a mandatory life sentence. Lesser murder charges do not. That's what was at stake. This was a bench trial, so Marvel knew they only had to convince a judge, not a jury. Law enforcement started to develop a theory that revenge was at play within the first 24 to 48 hours of Matthew's death.
From the first moment they're on scene, obviously they see Matthew and he's deceased. They hear from the dad, Matthew's father, on scene. And from that moment, they're able to piece together that Ruth Whitehead had fled to New Jersey to Cape May, and the car was in the ocean, but she was at their Wildwood residence. Immediately, detectives are bringing in family members to interview them, and they actually sat down with the defendant herself and interviewed her. And so from the interviews of family members, from the circumstances of Matthew's death, and from the defendant's own interview statement, it was very clear, especially from her interview statement, that this was in retaliation for what she perceived as the indignity her husband put her through by not giving her the life that she deserved.
In part one of this story, we explained how the defense used insanity as the basis of its case, arguing that Ruth's mental illness and delusional beliefs were fueled by four main stressors: financial problems, having to care for her mother who had dementia and was living in her home in Horsham, menopause, and ultimately having to sell the shore house in Wildwood Crest that had been in her family for years. Lauren Marvel and the prosecution didn't dismiss the idea that Ruth was under duress and experiencing immense pressure. What they refused to accept was that this was a good enough excuse or explanation for her to do what she did to her son.
We're constantly trying to figure out how to assess cases because you don't look at a case from the standpoint of what can I get out of this? What is the harshest punishment I can get? Throughout the entire process of preparing a case for trial, whether you're charging it from the beginning or whether the first assistant has made the charging decision and then given it to you, the entire process of getting it ready is also constantly assessing what is the right and fair thing to do here. So even though I came into it with a pretty firm sense of this was an intentional homicide and that this was not a mental health case, you know, there's always that component of someone is not right if they're making a decision to kill another person. Someone's not, you know, hopefully like everybody else is in their right frame of mind, but are they mentally ill to the extent that they're either guilty but mentally ill or criminally insane?
Gwendolyn Call delivered the opening statement for the prosecution. Right off the bat, she pinned Ruth with motive.
For Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead, every facet of her life was a status symbol. She wanted the public to perceive her as well-to-do. She sent her son to Germantown Academy, which is a very prominent private school institution. They lived in a pretty well-to-do area. They owned a beach house. Her husband was employed, and she also had a good job herself. So every asset of her life was just that, an asset for her to present to other people that she had this full and valuable life. And so when her husband, his business started failing and he stopped being able to pay for the things that she felt made her life valuable, including their beach house, she took that to heart and she took it as an offense at her personally. And that's where the revenge was triggered.
That was the prosecution's case. Revenge. Ruth wanted to get back at her husband, Daniel, for letting the family's finances fall apart. And when you seek revenge, how do you do it? With intention. With purpose. First-degree murder and a mandatory life sentence. Lauren Marvel used evidence to show there was tension.
There was a text message referenced, introduced by defense, and then we introduced it as well, where the defendant was texting Dan about what she brought into the family, what her family brought into the family. And that seemed to be something that really bothered her, that she brought into this marriage this status symbol asset from her parents. And then the text message was something along the lines of, what did your parents ever bring us but headaches or something to that effect? And then comparing her to his sister-in-law, indicating that she's so much better of a wife marrying into the family. There was a lot of resentment there.
Marvel and her team made a big deal about the family beach house in Wildwood Crest. If Ruth really did care about Matthew's best interest, she could have chalked up the sale as a hard choice, one that was painful, but would ultimately give her and Dan the money they needed, and then some, to afford Matthew the best education he could get. Instead, she couldn't get over selling the house. It was the final straw. Marvel and the prosecution said this was never about Matthew. It was all about Ruth's feelings toward Dan.
She had an $800,000 asset in her hands that she didn't have to work for, that was handed to her by her family members, that she's had just sitting there, available for their use. Anyone else that has dealt with some kind of financial struggle would think, my God, how lucky are we that she could just turn to that, sell that house. They sold it for $800,000. I mean, you know, Matthew was going to an expensive school, certainly, but they could have paid for his entire education. They could have paid for his college. They could have paid off their mortgage. I mean, truly, life-changing money for most people.
If only Dan had made more money and his business wasn't failing, they wouldn't have had to give up one of her cherished possessions.
That's what made it so much more about the symbolism of, you know, her husband has failed to hold up his end of the bargain. He has made her life hell. He has made her miserable. He's not fixing her from drowning. And now she has to sell this status symbol that she brought into the marriage. What did his family ever bring in? She has to rescue it. And she's so angry.
Ruth wanted revenge.
It hadn't been all of a sudden. In fact, it was months long ruminating over his failures as a husband to her and to the life that she wanted to have that led up to that ultimate precipitating factor, which was signing over her family's beach house, because it was important to her as a status symbol. And so when he took that away and she wasn't getting the life that she thought she deserved, that's when all bets were off the table and she wanted her husband to suffer. And how would he suffer most than to lose the son that he cherished, that he was just spending the night before his death talking about the baseball game that they were going to go to the first time the next day? Ultimately, at the end of the day, this built up for months until she finally decided that she had had enough and that she wasn't going to take the insults anymore from the husband who wasn't able to provide for her.
Matthew paid the price. When we come back, how the way Ruth murdered Matthew and the weapon she used only solidified the prosecution's belief that rage and retaliation, not insanity, were what truly made her kill. Plus, we'll revisit the moment when Dan Whitehead, Matthew's father and Ruth's husband, took the stand. Stay with us.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Dive into the start of summer at Whole Foods Market. Check out their Summer Splash event with sales on fresh organic produce, organic strawberries, and a fan favorite sale on Ben & Jerry's and Talenti. Explore deals on grill-friendly meats like organic air-chilled chicken breast, beef and chicken kebabs, all with no antibiotics ever from our meat department. Plus, grab easy sides from prepared foods and cool off with refreshing drinks. Kick off your summer and shop in store or online at Whole Foods Market today.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
I'm Jim Melwort. This is Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead, The Mother, The Monster, Part 2. Throughout Ruth's murder trial in February 2024, Montgomery County Assistant District Attorneys Lauren Marvel and Gwendolyn Call felt a constant pull between how they felt personally about the case and the way they knew they had to conduct themselves professionally. Their mothers. That any mom, regardless of circumstance, could somehow wrap a belt around the neck of her own sleeping child and pull it long enough to kill the child was impossible to imagine. Yet, at some point during the night of April 10th into April 11th, 2023, that's what Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead did to her son, Matthew. and she pulled and squeezed for somewhere in the range of 3 to 5 minutes in order to murder him.
Even coming into this case as prosecutors, as investigators, it's easy to start with, I guess, kind of the bias that everybody comes into the world with in this mindset of, especially female killers, I think, this mentality of snapping, right? And there's TV shows about Snapped and stuff like that.
This is Lauren Marvel.
I think your brain tries to reconcile that with what we tend to believe about the world, what we tend to believe about women and mothers. So your brain kind of goes into this thinking of, all right, well, something must be, right? Something must be wrong with her. She must have lost her mind.
Gwendolyn Call felt there was a Jekyll and Hyde dynamic to the story.
By all accounts, family members, friends, teachers, even her husband, everyone did see her as a loving mother. Even her own statements to doctors who were analyzing her for whether or not she met the criteria for legal insanity had said she seemed to love him. She even stated, if Matthew knew why, he would understand. So in one level, she justified it to herself for why she did it. But ultimately, at the same time, she was able to overcome her own love for her child just to get back at her husband.
This is what the evidence told them. Revenge and retaliation was the premise they had to follow. Based on Ruth's crime, the only way Marvel and Cole felt like they could deliver justice to Matthew Whitehead's name was by way of a first-degree murder verdict. Ruth had to be put away for the rest of her life with no chance to get out. Critical to the prosecution's case was how Ruth killed Matthew. Cole thought strangulation was a telling detail that opened a window into Ruth's mind.
Explain that, if you can, of why strangulation kind of takes homicide to another level almost.
Strangulation is a unique method to kill someone, and I say unique meaning there's really no other purpose for strangling someone other than intending to kill them, because you can do it with just your hands versus, in this case, using a belt. So going that step further and using a tool to do it. And then it takes approximately 3 to 5 minutes of continuous pressure on the neck area. So either the airway or the major blood vessels in your neck for a person to die. And so that's very close. You have to be within arm's length for that to happen. And it's a long period to sustain pressure. And so in this case, she could have stopped at any time and he might have survived, but she continuously held pressure for 3 to 5 minutes and waited until he was dead.
It wasn't just any belt. It was one of Daniel Whitehead's belts, a belt that belonged to Matthew's father and Ruth's husband, who was sleeping across the hall when she killed their son. This was no coincidence, according to prosecutors.
The doctor also mentioned that this was a wide ligature. So it was Dan's belt that was used in this case. It was not, say, a rope or a wire. And that's important, too, because since the pressure is extended over a broader area, it may take longer or it may take more force to apply the same amount of pressure as it would a focused wire or focused rope ligature. And so the doctor pointed that out, which just, again, is another way of showing that not only was this premeditated, but it was her specific intention to kill her son in that moment.
Ruth committed to doing this. She saw and felt the act through to the end. According to her video statement given to a Montgomery County detective later in the day of her arrest on April 11th, 2023, Ruth said Matthew had been crying all the time, that it was because the family was struggling. He was upset. They were, quote, going to be poor. Cull and the prosecution refuted the notion that this was a mercy killing.
Defense had raised the issue of that she killed her son because he was upset about the finances. He was so distraught over the family state that it would have been better for him to be dead than to grow up in a destitute life. But her own text messages did not show that concern at any moment prior to killing Matthew. She never researched childhood depression. She never researched what to do if my kid's upset about money and finances. She never researched any of those topics. She didn't even research child suicide. She only researched adult suicide and homicide. And so that's very telling that this was not about Matthew. It was about her. So it all goes to her perspective and her rationale and not what was in Matthew's mind or upsetting him at the time, which by all accounts, he was a normal kid living a normal child's life. And he was not concerned about any of the issues that she raised as a concern for herself.
The defense tried to frame the murder as an act of altruistic maternal filicide, that a mother would kill her child to spare them a life of hardship. The prosecution countered by saying Matthew's murder was indeed an act of filicide, just not the kind the defense claimed. Marvel and prosecutors called it revenge filicide, when one parent kills a child to get back at the other.
When the defense expert is talking about these altruistic suicides where they're trying to save their children from a horrible fate, she didn't do that. She didn't call the police and say, "I've saved my son. Come help me because I've saved my son." She didn't write a letter to her husband saying, "You're welcome for saving our son from this horrible fate." She didn't go back to bed, you know, and just live her life as normal, as you might anticipate someone would if they were truly believing that there was nothing wrong with what they just did. What she did was she took the time and the thought to set out a message for her husband. The only interpretation of this message was that she hated him and she wanted him to be in pain. And then she took his belt that she had used to strangle her son, got into their car, and drove to the town where they got married to drive into the ocean. In these cases, you have to find every scrap of insight into someone's mind that you can, because that is the critical thing in a homicide case, what someone is thinking at the time that they killed someone. And all you have to prove that is their decisions just before and just after, usually.
From the day Ruth was taken into custody to the trial itself 10 months later, prosecution seized on several opportunities to call out Ruth's reaction in what many people would consider highly emotional situations, especially for a mother who was processing the reality she'd murdered her child. Montgomery County Detective Heather Long testified that in her videotaped interview with Ruth on the day of Ruth's arrest, Detective Long noticed there weren't any tears in Ruth's eyes when she was sobbing about what she did. Gwendolyn Call took note.
You saw this in the video during trial. When asked about killing Matthew, she pretended to cry. She wasn't actually crying. And then as soon as the investigator shifted gears and asked her about her husband, instantly she changed into a logical, rational person who had no tears, wasn't commenting or thinking about her son's death at all. She only focused on the question that she was asked. So she was very logical and rational and thought out at that time.
Prosecutors also pointed out that the only time Ruth showed any real emotion during the trial was when her April 11th, 2023 videoed interview with Heather Long was played in court, and Ruth had a complete meltdown. It was so bad, she asked if she could be excused from the courtroom. We talked about this moment in part one of the podcast, too. It made Lauren Marvel consider something.
I don't recall, and, you know, the trial's a bit of a blur, but I don't recall a moment where she talked about missing her son. I don't remember it. And when she cried, it was when she had to see herself confess to the murder. It wasn't when the medical examiner was on the stand talking about how the defendant would have had to have held that belt on his throat for 15 seconds for him to lose consciousness while he saw stars and lost hearing and felt pain. And then she would have to continue holding the belt that tight to cut off his oxygen for at least minutes after to kill him. She didn't cry like that during that. the part of this case that takes my breath away is thinking about this little boy going to bed with his mom that he trusts so much as a safe place, and whether he realized it was her that was killing him. What were his final moments? Was he looking at her? Was he realizing that it was his mom? Was he scared because he didn't know? That's what takes my breath away. And those were the moments that that testimony was about. And she sat there. But when it came time to face head on what she admitted to doing, the most damning evidence, that's where she couldn't sit any further.
The judge allowed Ruth to leave the courtroom. Prosecutors didn't stand in the way.
I can tell you a big part of me wanted to say, no, you should have to sit here for every moment. Matthew didn't get to leave. He didn't get to tap out of his final moments. And all you have to do is sit here and watch yourself give a self-serving confession to a detective. No, you should have to sit here for every second. You know, at the end of the day, she was able to leave, and we certainly didn't object to that. We all had a job to do when we needed to get through the testimony, and whether she was there or not wouldn't change that. But you have those human moments as a prosecutor where you're looking at the situation and you're thinking, that's not fair. You shouldn't get to walk away from facing yourself.
There was one person Ruth couldn't get away from facing, her husband, Daniel. Second to Matthew, no one had suffered more from Ruth's actions. Daniel and Ruth got married in 2011. He was 44, she was 38. The ceremony was held at Congress Hall in Cape May. 12 years later, Ruth drove their 2019 black Toyota Highlander into the ocean right around the same spot after she left the murder scene in Horsham. Prosecutors said this was intentional. They thought Ruth was sending a vindictive message to Daniel, just like she did when she chose to use his belt to kill Matthew. It was Dan who was responsible for the family problems. He wasn't making any money, so he deserved to be punished. Gwendolyn Call and the prosecution called him as a witness midway through the first day.
We didn't get to learn much about Dan. We kept our distance during trial, obviously, after what he's been through. And his testimony, you know, was short, and his statement during sentencing was focused on Matthew. What did you learn about Dan?
He was and is a devoted father to Matthew, and he was, and to a point still is, a devoted husband to Ruth Whitehead. From all of the evidence we had and all of our interactions, we could see that he just truly cared, and he wanted to do everything the right way for all of his family, because family meant the world to him.
This is what stood out to Lauren Marvel.
My favorite story from this case has been from Germantown Academy, talking about Dan dropping off Matthew every morning, saying, love you, son, and Matthew saying, love you, dad, every single morning. And anyone who's interacted with an 11-year-old knows that it's a big deal that this kid was vocally, publicly telling his dad that he loves him every single day. And meeting Dan, it was a little bit of a glimpse into the person that he was before he lost his son. Because by the time we met him, he has endured more trauma than is really fathomable.
In part one of this podcast, we detailed Ruth's close relationship with Matthew, how she breastfed him until he was 3, how she would pull over on the side of the road when he was young to look at construction sites. But as Matthew got older, he got closer to Dad. This was another factor prosecutors felt that was fueling Ruth's rage.
Kids are supposed to distance themselves a little bit from parents as they get older. They get more excited about spending time with friends than they do about their parents. They're not the little boy in the back of the car that wants to stop and see the construction site. They're the 11-year-old that wanted to play a game online with his friends instead of going out to dinner with his parents. That closeness with a child, I would argue, can change over time and be a little bit less serving to someone who is more focused on what she looks like to the world. If her identity was being a good mom and being this loving, nurturing mother who nursed her son for so long, who would stop at construction sites, whose son adored her, and then she's getting older and he's not adoring her quite as much, he's more asserting his independence as he should, there's less connection there, I think, and there's less image service.
When Daniel Whitehead took the witness stand on February 12th, you could feel the emotion. You could feel his loss when he talked about how much he cared for Ruth and how close they were when they first got married when Matthew was younger. And then you could feel the rage when he shifted from referring to her as his wife or as Ruth, and partway through his testimony started referring to her as the defendant. Marvel took it all in.
You mentioned in your history of your job that you deal with a lot of horrible cases. Seeing Dan come in and take the stand when they had to stop was one of the more emotional scenes that I've seen in a courtroom. Can you explain kind of what that was like when he just broke down?
It's one of the things that I've had to wrestle with in prosecuting this case is it is so horrific that if you let yourself fully experience that, it's hard to pull back out of. So a lot of times when you're a prosecutor, when you're interacting in the court system, you put up these walls to try to protect yourself, because if you go down that path of grief with every person that gets on the stand, you can't do your job protecting them. And every once in a while, you'll have these interactions where you let yourself feel the case a little bit. And it was so hard throughout this entire case to try to keep that wall up. And watching Dan's grief on the stand, you could feel it in the room. You know, people will say that. You could feel the heaviness in the room. You could feel the tension in the room, whatever. But you could – his grief was tangible. As a human being, but as a parent, you know, something about seeing him – this big guy – who otherwise doesn't come across as very emotional, just unable to speak because he was so overcome by his grief. That's something that we experienced every time we spoke to him. Because we get to have this hearing and then walk away and pick up another file and go back to our families. But he has this hearing and then he goes home to the house where he found his son and no one else. No one else is in that home with him. And he lives that grief every moment of the day.
Dan never denied he and Ruth were having a hard time. He also acknowledged his shortcomings in business were part of the family's problem. He just never saw it ending like this. His son murdered. His wife possibly doing it to get back at him. Her now going away to prison for the rest of her life.
In one moment, everything about that family was gone. And he's left to reconcile that this woman that he loved, that he had a child with, that he trusted, killed someone. And then on top of it, didn't just kill someone, isn't just a murderer, killed his own son, took his son from him. Someone that he believed that she loved, and then dealing with the loss of his son that he just absolutely adored.
As Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead's 3-day trial started to wind down, the prosecution continued to stick to their evidence. Gwendolyn Call didn't think there was much merit to the defense argument that four forces in Ruth's life were responsible for her descent. Money, her mother's dementia, menopause, and the Shore House.
I'm glad that they didn't play into this because I think those are stressors that all of us face in daily life.
So to use those as an excuse for homicide is completely unjustifiable.
In prosecutors' eyes, insanity and mental illness weren't sufficient arguments either.
In this particular case, Pennsylvania law requires that you show that first there's a mental disease or defect, and then second, that that mental disease or defect is so severe that it prevents the person from understanding what they're doing is wrong or appreciating the consequences of their actions. And so when you're looking at the legal requirements for insanity, first, the Commonwealth showed that it was in dispute whether or not she actually had a mental disease or defect to begin with. Even if she did have depression or a personality disorder that led to this, that's not enough under Pennsylvania law for a mental disease or defect. But even if you agreed with the doctor that her depression had psychotic features, every piece of evidence that we had around the time of the offense showed that she knew what she was doing was wrong.
Ruth's depression was central to the defense mental health and insanity claims. She was researching suicide, they said. But Lauren Marvel wasn't completely buying it. There was no evidence that Ruth was actually going to try to kill herself. Only threats. Maybe even manipulation? This is such a difficult topic. No one, including me, is discounting the challenges and pain associated with suicide. Prosecutors had to walk a fine line, but they also weren't going to back down.
It is so uncomfortable to have any kind of conversation pertaining to suicide when there's anything less than a supportive tone to it, right? Because if someone is dealing with suicidal thoughts, we want them to get help. We want them to be believed and trusted and have access to everything that they need. And it's a very strange position to be in where you're in any way criticizing or questioning someone's sincerity there. So with that being said, my argument was that she was considering suicide. That was one of the considered ways out after what she did. She thought about it. She thought about what it would look like, what it would feel like. She thought very in depth about all of the options there. And I also argued that when she would throw those statements out to her husband, they were manipulative. If this were someone who had not just killed their son, it's a very different conversation. That's someone that needs help. And she did need help. She certainly did. But in this case, where she was bringing up conversations about her suicidality was very self-serving. It was in the context of she had killed her son, she was in police custody, and she needed to figure out what to do next. Or it was in the context of conversations with her husband, where she felt he wasn't doing enough to save their family financially, and she needed to motivate him. And I think that that's one way that she tried to motivate him, was to make him feel like if he failed financially, she would kill herself, or her misery of being so upset to the point that she was suicidal was his fault.
On February 16th, 2024, Montgomery County Court of Common Pleas Judge William Carpenter delivered the sentence. Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead was guilty of first-degree murder, the highest punishment, mandatory life in prison. Assistant District Attorneys from Montgomery County, Lauren Marvel and Gwendolyn Call, accomplished what they set out to do. They convinced the judge Ruth killed with intent, for revenge, not out of insanity. But in a case like this, there really aren't any winners. You could even say there isn't much justice or closure, just loss.
The hardest part of the job is trying to empathize with your victims and sit with them in their grief and support them, and then also trying to protect yourself, protect your own heart so that you can go back to your family, keep living the life that you need to live for your people, for your family, and keep doing this job every day without being so affected by it that you can't continue.
Moments after the sentence was handed down outside the courtroom, Call held up a collage of photos of Matthew provided by his school, Germantown Academy. There were 8 pictures on it from various stages of Matthew's life, of him doing different activities young kids do. At the bottom, there was a photo of him and his dad, Dan.
I have prosecuted other cases involving children as victims, but this was the first homicide I had involving a child victim. And so as a mother, that was really upsetting and very challenging. At the end of the day, I know that we did do the right thing in this case and that we were able to speak up for Matthew where he's no longer able to speak for himself. And I believe we did get justice by securing that first-degree murder conviction and the lifetime sentence.
As far as what happens next, Ruth's attorney, Eugene Tenari, filed an appeal, ultimately hoping for a less harsh sentence.
I respect the court's ruling in this case, as I always do. I'm just saying that we presented a different scenario, and of course we're disappointed that the court didn't agree with us. But as I said, I respect it.
Tenari saw a mother, not a monster.
I truly believe that she was suicidal as a result of the severe depression. And that severe depression caused a detachment from reality because to me, again, there is no other explanation other than mental illness, with all due respect to the court and the Commonwealth, that explains how a mother who loves her son that much can think that this was the way to solve all his problems and her problems through this altruistic filicide. That's born out of mental illness, not anger to your husband for losing some money.
As of this recording, Ruth is being held at SCI Muncie in north central Pennsylvania, which is where all women go when they enter the state prison system in Pennsylvania. We talked to her brother, Dimitri DiRienzo, outside the courtroom before sentencing. He never could have imagined his sister doing what she did.
It's difficult to see what you see in everyday life and interactions and equate them to what's actually happening in the human mind, right? Like, I think that's like, you know, seeing her express, you know, being upset about things or just being, you know, sad about things, to recognize that these were the red flags, or just we just didn't have awareness for that. And that's the difficult aspect of it.
And if you don't mind, can you tell us a little bit about Matthew? I know we've heard from other people.
Wonderful boy. He really was. He was close with my boys, you know, they're his first cousins. And he was just such a sad, sad outcome. He paid the ultimate price and he had nothing to do with it.
One life lost, a family that will never be the same, and a community wrestling with what led to this. In her closing argument, Lauren Marvel addressed not only the judge, but also courtroom observers who wanted to believe this was psychosis, a mental break. Marvel argued, no one wants to think someone they know, someone from their community, or any mother could do this to their child.
It calls into question their own understanding of other people, their relationships. If you understand as true, if you recognize as true that this person who's been in your life for decades, who you sat across the table with, who you prayed with at church, who you were in the PTA with, is capable of something horrendous on any case, it makes you question, what did I miss? Am I incapable of catching this kind of thing? Does that mean I'm less safe than I assume I am? It's a lot more comfortable for people in those situations to fall back on, well, that person must be lying, or that's not what that evidence says. When the reality is, all of the objective evidence said otherwise.
Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead, The Mother, The Monster, is a production of KYW News Radio Original Podcast. Ryan Seltzer is our producer. Christina Koppeser is KYW News Radio's brand manager. Tom Rickert is KYW News Radio's director of podcasting. Kevin McCory is KYW News Radio's news director. Special thanks to KYW News Radio senior visual producer Holly Stevens, Eugene Tenari, Gwendolyn Call, and Lauren Marvel. To read more about Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead's murder trial, check out the links in the show notes. You can follow KYW News Radio on social media at KYW News Radio and online at kywnewsradio.com. Listen to KYW News Radio original podcasts free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your pods. I'm Jim Melwort. You can find me on social media at jmelwort. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health or is in danger of self-harm or suicide, call 988.
Dive into the start of summer at Whole Foods Market. Check out their summer splash event with sales on fresh organic produce, organic strawberries, and a fan favorite sale on Ben & Jerry's and Talenti. Explore deals on grill-friendly meats like organic air-chilled chicken breast, beef and chicken kebabs, all with no antibiotics ever from our meat department. Plus, grab easy sides from prepared foods and cool off with refreshing drinks. Kick off your summer and shop in-store or online at Whole Foods Market today.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature. Whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to, or the succulents that adorn our homes, nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.